Feeding Matters understands the significant financial difficulty that comes with supporting a loved one with PFD or ARFID. Each fall, we open the Family Assistance Program. Applications for the 2026 cycle are currently being accepted and are due October 11th. Learn more and apply today at itsnotpickyeating.org.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Welcome to Feeding Does Matter. My name is Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters, and I am here today with Dr. Nikhila Raul, who is chair of our advocacy pillar of the Feeding Alliance. And this is an effort for us to really dive a little bit deeper into the Feeding Alliance because it is filled with the most passionate and the most amazing volunteers who really do so much to move this mission and this movement forward. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the advocacy pillar. So Nikhila, maybe share a little bit about yourself and your background, how you even came to found this work in general. I would love to learn more.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you so much for having me, Jacqueline. I'm excited just to talk a little bit about what we do and how, my thoughts on getting involved in this kind of work. I am a pediatric otolaryngologist and an associate professor of otolaryngology and pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital. I'm actually the surgical director of the feeding and swallowing program there. It's interesting. I think I became a part of Feeding Matters almost by luck because I was working with people who were heavily involved in my previous position. And what I learned from the people I worked with, as well as becoming a part of Feeding Matters, is that, you know, all of us who work with kids in this arena are often working in silos. And I think what Feeding Matters does is kind of brings all the people together that are, you know, trying to improve care for kids with pediatric feeding disorder, and not just the medical providers, but also parents and other community folks who are invested in this patient population, and these children, really, I should say. And so for me as a pediatric otolaryngologist, often I'm just working on like, oh, I'm a surgeon. I'm just fixing problems with kids have with swallowing or whatnot. But what I've found in working through this multidisciplinary type of organization is that it's way beyond just do a surgery. The impact on families, the impact on the rest of their lives, the financial component, the early detection, all these things are so important. And if we don't work together, we're probably not going to move the needle in improving care for these kids.
So, so true. And I really appreciate your willingness to kind of be open to understand that and like lean into that. I think there's so much value that you bring to the Alliance from your perspective as a provider in otolaryngology, because it's not, the traditional volunteers within our organization are very much feeding therapists. And we're always trying to talk about how do we get to physicians? How do we get to specialists? And so it's just wonderful to be able to have a champion in yourself and being able to share that link with us and allow us to really think about how we do that a little bit further. And we're grateful that you found us as well. So Nikhila, tell us a little bit about the Feeding Alliance and specifically the advocacy pillar.
So for those who aren't aware of the Alliance, it's really just a network that brings, like I was saying, the whole organization is really designed to bring all different people together. So the Alliance is this network that brings families, that brings healthcare providers and other people who advocate for our kids, brings them together to try to, as I said, improve the care of kids with pediatric feeding disorder. And we do that through multiple different arms. And so I'm, you know, my area of interest and kind of what I head up is the advocacy pillar, which I think you can look at that in many different ways. We could look at, I think the traditional way we think about advocacy is like lobbying and government and things like that. But when you really think about advocating for these kids, there's so many areas at which advocacy can occur. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, advocating for even early detection, advocating for accommodations at school, advocating for insurance benefits, advocating for policy change to help care for these kids. So I think that's where I find it really exciting that there are a lot of different levers that we can pull to try to move things forward, and people can get involved kind of in whichever area they feel like is most accessible to them and most feasible for them to have an impact.
Yeah, that's so true. Because I think people do think of advocacy in the traditional sense, and I think that we really approach it very differently. I think for many different reasons, but there's so many different ways to advocate. And in that sense, there's so many different ways for people to get involved in that advocacy work in general. We've always felt like we've made a lot of movement in the system by kind of being more of the alternative to advocacy, that like more relationship building and strategic partnership and collaboration and outreach and really thinking about it from like what levers can we pull even outside of maybe policy, knowing that, you know, policy needs to be a part of it and will be a part of it in the future. But there's so many things that need to happen either first or in partnership with policy.
And I think I was just saying that I think, you know, being a part of this effort has actually changed my view of it also, because I think the hard part about looking at it, if it's just policy, is it's such a huge task to change policy. You know, that takes years and years of effort. And you frankly have to have some movement on the ground to say, hey, look at these things that we've done. If you do this on a larger scale, this is the impact that you could have. So I almost think if you look at like almost like micro advocacy, there are a lot of small things that you can do to make small improvements, which obviously then can lead to a big change.
Yep. And that's exactly how we look at it, is like, what do we need to do to build that movement, knowing that's also going to fall in our future as well. And so I think like the advocacy pillar chairs before you have done a lot as it relates to really advocating for early detection, really thinking about what does it look like to do that outreach piece and the awareness piece, and really thinking through it in those different lenses. And what I like about how the Feeding Alliance works is every leader brings their own flavor to their work. And you have been in this position, I'm going to get it wrong, like a year, maybe a year and a half?
I think almost 2 years.
Oh, yeah, because it was last year at in-person conference. Yeah, so totally is almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And so tell me a little bit about how you approached advocacy and how you thought of setting your goals when we did the goal setting within the Feeding Alliance.
Yeah. So like I said, when I first came into it, I really was looking at it more from like a policy, big picture type of view. And after meeting with others in the Alliance and hearing other people's viewpoints, honestly, I realized like to advocate for it can mean so many different things. And so the way I kind of broke it up was, how do we advocate for kids? How do we advocate for families? How do we advocate for the physicians who take care of these kids? And then how do we do, like I said, local advocacy versus at the community and family level? And then how do we look at national policy? I think we've done a good job of really tackling the more of the local, like grassroots almost efforts to start, because that can have immediate impact on our kids and they don't have to wait.
Right.
And so that really changing that mindset for me allowed me to tackle something that was more feasible and definitely to do it alone. I think having input from other folks who take care of kids like this, whether it's SLP, OT, dietitians, also parents. Like parents have been a huge part. And working with the parent council has been super helpful in understanding what the actual needs are. What do we actually need to advocate for to improve the lives of their children?
Yeah. And one of the things that you tackled initially and right away in your chair role was the school toolkit. And I really loved that because it honestly had been something that we knew we needed to tackle, but everything always feels like this running list of things that need to get done. And you were able to say, like, let's do this. Like, let's see what needs to happen and work in partnership with so many people to make it happen.
Yeah. And I think I didn't realize until I started really looking at this that pediatric feeding disorder was not really considered. It's not a named disability per se.
Yeah.
And so it was hard. It was almost nebulous, I think, to even school administrators and teachers and nurses, like, what do we do for these kids at school? And I think then if there's no blueprint for it, for the people who provide the services, then it was hard for parents. You know, they're like, well, we expect you to know this because you're caring for our kids. And then I think by meeting with the parent and family council, it was understanding that, hey, these are the deficits, and these are where we feel like if you could give us some tools to understand, one, what support we should expect, and two, how we can help our schools give our kids the support that we should expect, then we can be much more successful in providing our kids what they need from a feeding standpoint to allow them to then get what they need from school from an educational standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know it's tough because I've heard it described from many different individuals that are taking care of kids at schools. Not only is it like how parents and caregivers feel about it, that like we've seen some just awful scenarios where, you know, tube feedings weren't treated as mealtimes, or doctor's orders weren't followed around tube feedings, and just like that there wasn't an acknowledgement that this disorder existed. And so there's just been some awful things. But then I also hear and can understand how challenging it is from the like the school administration side, where they've got a lot to manage. It's hard to do some of the individualized stuff. And so it's like anything else. It's trying to find like what that middle ground is. And you all did a great job of like really trying to lay out some of the tools to really support education and awareness first, before we get to even like, this is how you make it happen. And huge shout out right now, because right now during back to school time, there's so many people that are starting to buy the It's In My Own Way books. And with that purchase, awesome, you get to bring the school toolkit into your school. And so it's a really great time to be able to be talking about the school toolkit. But
yeah,
it's a huge success from your tenure even thus far as chair in the advocacy pillar. And then that leads
to... if you don't know, if you're not super familiar with it, essentially, if you go to our website, you'll see that it has some parts in it like Know Your Rights. So you know what the Americans with Disability Act looks like. You know what a 504 plan versus an IEP, what these things look like. And generally, PFD or pediatric feeding disorder falls under any, it's kind of in a miscellaneous category. And I think, you know, from a lot of educators that normal mealtimes for your average kids are inadequate. So it's almost like,
yeah, like the cafeteria is scarred for anybody.
Anybody. Yes.
Yep.
So then you can imagine these poor kiddos who it's a little harder for them and there's no support there.
Right.
So, I think essentially there's a component on Know Your Rights, and then there's a get to know my kid type of component to it too, which I really love that part, because one thing about PFD is it's like the absolute opposite of a monolithic disorder. It is so all encompassing that kids with PFD look so different, or can look so different. And so it really highlights, like, first of all, of course, the basic things like what my kiddo eats, if it's tube feeds, if it's certain types of foods. But we worked with, I'm so sorry, Jen, I'm having a brain fart. Yes,
yeah,
Jen Braggart.
Yeah, out of Wisconsin.
Fantastic SLP, Wisconsin, just amazing.
Yeah.
And her expertise was so critical in really making this successful. She talked about maybe including things like, oh, these types of things make me anxious around mealtime. Or also like these, sitting by these friends makes me feel more comfortable. But, you know, it's like really about your child. And so I really, just to make eating and feeding, mealtime feel normal, as close to normal as we can make it at school. And so please, if you haven't checked it out yet, I really think that you would get a lot of good information from it and find some way that it would be applicable if you take care of kids with this issue or if you're a parent with a kiddo with this problem.
Yeah, so true. So if you need to access that for a child with PFD or ARFID, you can go to itsnotbigeating.org and there's a list of resources in the family. The school toolkit is a part of that. Definitely huge shout out to that. And so Nikhila, it did make me think about like kind of that difference of like how the parents are feeling about it and how the school is feeling about it and just like a no-win scenario sometimes. And that's how I almost feel a little bit about early detection, which is, you know, parents and caregivers and us as like the feeding community have like been asking for this to be a focus in well visits. And then on the pediatrician side, I understand like they're trying to do a lot with a little and they've got like 15 minutes and they've got all of these like different pieces that are involved in how their practices are set up and what they're being told to do and all of these things. And so again, it feels like a no-win scenario, but I feel like you in your goal setting really identified what might be a step in the right direction for helping with early detection. So maybe share a little bit about
that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think all of us, because we just care about kids, we will do a lot of things because it's the right thing to do. Right. And unfortunately, in the reality of the, of the medical community is there's like you said, Jacqueline, there's only X amount of time to take care of all these things. And we've seen with other early detection of other things, the way to make it happen was to have a screening tool, first of all, and Feeding Matters has done a great job with that, but also build it in, give people who, people who evaluate feeding should be given credit for evaluating feeding or screening for feeding. And so I think about my SLP friends, or even when now that when I do it in my own clinic, when I don't have an SLP with me, I try to use a code as much as possible to get credit for being like, okay, when I say code, I'm talking about the CPT code to say, hey, I did a feeding evaluation. I should be able to bill for this. In the same manner, I think we all believe that if pediatricians are taking the time to do this, they should be getting credit from their work, we call them relative value units, work RVUs, and financial compensation for it. Not because they do it because they're going to make a bunch of money off of it, but they do it because it's the right thing to do for the kiddo and they should be recognized for doing the right thing for the child. And unfortunately, the way that things work and gain recognition in medicine or in the medical community is by having a code associated with it. We know that an ICD-10 for pediatric feeding disorder being introduced, I guess 5 years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, we're coming up on the 5-year anniversary in October.
Yes. I mean, that made a difference in coding for that and recognizing that undoubtedly. So if you think about screening for hearing loss, for vision impairment, for even for autism or for any of these, for food insecurity. That is a routine part now of pediatrician's visits. The reason you do it is because we have to find these things early. And using the questionnaire and taking the time to do it, I believe as an organization that a code should be associated with that to give pediatricians, obviously to give them credit for it, but also to give them permission to spend time doing it. And so, you know, that's one way that we're really lobbying for making it a normal part. And it doesn't necessarily mean the pediatrician has to do it, but they're during that visit, there's a lot of people who see the kids, right? They have an MA, they have a nurse. Sometimes those screening are done by those ancillary staff members. And then if there is a concern, they picked up on something that is abnormal that may hint at a vision disorder, hearing impairment, or pediatric feeding disorder, then you know who to refer them to for the next steps to have a full evaluation. So I think that is where we're at in that we don't want to overburden pediatricians.
No,
we want to give them and I should say pediatric providers, because I know a lot of our APPs also manage patients. Yep. But we want to give them a tool to quickly screen and pick up on these abnormalities. So then you know, it's an easy way to not miss this, pick it up early and then send them to the right people.
Yeah. And it becomes a part of your system. I mean, I think one of the biggest ahas for us in this was, you know, you have well-meaning pediatricians who kind of run out of time, but then they're the way that the business is set up, they have their process and their protocols for what gets screened and how it gets built in and how their billing works. And to your point, it's not about kind of getting paid for it. It's just a natural part of like, how do we need to set up our system for evaluations and screenings in particular. And I love the idea that this is just to catch when we need to look a little bit deeper. But if we can get every kid to really be screened, then we can pick up some of these things a little bit earlier.
Yeah. And the truth is, it's not like when you do all these vision and hearing screenings that are routinely scheduled, it's not like most of the kids pass. And that's what we hope with PFD too, right? It's like most of the kids, we expect
we're really hoping that they do pass.
But we're going to find the one, if you're actually looking for it, you're going to find those who need help early. And that's what we're trying to do so that we're not, you know, leading them to all the down, you know, we're preventing all those downstream consequences that can be just much harder to reverse.
For sure. Yeah. The domino effect and the impact as they get older, for sure. And more expensive too, as we're talking about.
Absolutely. Yes.
I've been really thinking about lobbying and all of that. So I'm really excited about that project for sure.
Me too.
And you've done a great job really thinking through and leading it. And how do we make the pitch? Because some of these things are very like they're not straightforward. It's not like there's this form that you fill out and ta-da, you've got it. Like you really have to navigate a complicated system to be able to figure out what to do. And you've done that.
Yeah. And it's figuring out. It's like talking to the right people to figure out. This may sound casual. Who cares? Right?
Enough,
and we,
like, make,
you know,
make the pitch.
Exactly. And we talk about like change management, right? I just happened to take this recent class that's talking about change management. And the key is really finding the stakeholders who feel like you do and generating, like you said, generating momentum early on. So then eventually, as you show the benefits of doing this, then other people start to see it and catch on. But you got to figure out, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job of talking to other groups who care for these kiddos who are like, yeah, this is a great idea. And then really trying to get collaborative support.
Great. So thank you for that, for sure. So in terms of what I know, because that's an active project right now, as well as the partnership that you're doing with a lot of the other projects that happen between pillars, because like the education pillar and advocacy pillar, I almost think of as like really closely related.
Sisters, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Because of how much is happening with POP and medical education outreach and some of that stuff. But what else do you feel like is a part of what advocacy looks like, either right now or what ideas do you have for what you want in the future?
Yeah. So I think that if anybody is interested in advocacy, getting involved in your local community council for your state or your region is super helpful. So you know what's going on at the local level. Again, some of these might look like micro advocacy efforts, but you might be able to apply it. And there are people doing really good work trying to get to the state, to the state legislature and whatnot, to push some things through. So I think that is a great place to start, and you find other like-minded people and can generate ideas for next steps. The hope that I have for our next steps is obviously we have some organizations who are partnering with us with increasing recognition, but I'm hoping once we build momentum around the CPT, then we work with the education pillar to then actively educate people on it so that the CPT has meaning.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a checkbox.
It's just getting it done. Like, you have to disseminate, make people know what it is. There's so much more that will come after you get that done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I know, and I don't know how much you all talked about like the videos that are being put together for education.
We did a little bit, but I feel like I don't assume that everybody listens to every single episode. So feel free to.
Yeah.
That again. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's just been great, these great explainer videos that have been put together and are coming together to really talk about the different components of PFD to understand that. I think a lot of people, you know, we've talked a lot about this, it's not just picky eating, right? We have to get out of some of that language, but understanding what is the line between typical toddler refusal and, hey, this is a problem. And that's one example, but also the medical component where we're talking about difficulty swallowing, or how do medical problems with swallowing then lead to behavioral problems? I think those explainer videos do a fantastic job of walking people who are new to the area through it. So that when we're asking you to do this screening and get credit for it, it's also because you have an understanding of the implications of not identifying this early, or how you can be a change maker in helping with early identification.
Yep, so true. And that's really the goal. I mean, our mission is really focused on early identification, and that is, like, those are the steps to be able to get us there. Anything I didn't ask that you wanted to share about the pillar, the alliance itself, the community councils?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I would say is, if any idea I feel like that you bring to this alliance is always considered. And so, because the viewpoints that people have are so diverse, that I would encourage anybody who has any ideas to bring it to us. And you can do it through the app, you know, community app. We're easily accessible. If you look on the website,
yeah, anybody, we will get it on that for sure.
Yes. And so I think those are always where our next initiatives are coming from what we're hearing from the community. So if you're involved in advocacy efforts, or you want to get involved and you have an idea, please reach out. And I am all ears to understand where we need to go and where we're really lacking.
Yeah. Wonderful, Nikhila. Thank you so much for your leadership and your passion, and just being such a great volunteer for leading this work forward. I'm really grateful for you.
Thank you. I feel fortunate to be a part of the community.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And we will see everybody next week. But if you've got questions on the Alliance, please know you can reach out to us. And we encourage you to join any pillar, or even just be part of the communication, so you see what's happening at the Alliance. Thanks, everyone. Have a good one.